It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll mark the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act of 1964, and we'll talk about how its legacy lives on today.
First, our next guest has spent years visiting the Mercado Oriental, Central America's largest market. The market is a sprawling maze of vendors, and as the saying goes, if it's not for sale there, you maybe can't buy it anywhere.
Our guest says the Nicaraguan market is an example of the world's growing underground economy. Instead of having formal jobs with benefits, whole families work off the books. They have flexibility, but no health insurance, sick leave, or social security. After the global recession, estimates put the world's underground economy at about $2 trillion.
Douglas Haynes joins us now to talk about his time at the Mercado Oriental. He's an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. He recently wrote about the market for Orion magazine. Douglas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So when did you first start spending time at the Mercado Oriental in Nicaragua?
I first went there in May 2008 when I led a group of study abroad students working in conjunction with a nonprofit organization called Compas de Nicaragua, which facilitates cross-cultural exchange. And that's where I met Dayani Baudelomar, who's the focus of this piece in Orion. And I've developed a relationship with her over the years, continued going back to the market as I'm working on a book project in which she plays a role there. Diane has been working in the market for a little over 10 years at her own fruit and drink stand. She also grew up in the market when her parents migrated to the city from the countryside when she was 9 years old. So she's basically been working as a street vendor all her life.
I'm sure to a certain extent it has to be seen to be believed, but could you describe the market for us? What would first hit you when you saw it?
So, Diane works in a place called El Gancho de Caminos, or the Road's Hook, which is a major intersection in Managua where there are a lot of buses that come through and where most people are going into the market, the heart of the market, arrive. So when you get off the bus there and you walk into the heart of the market, you're surrounded by this swirl of activity. It's rows and rows and, like you said, a maze of stalls. They're mostly metal stalls, but as you go deeper and deeper into the market, they get closer and closer together. You are surrounded by people pushing carts, women calling out the names of their products, men lugging sacks of produce, goods spilling out into the aisles, into the alleys of the market. There's running gray water going through the market. There's a huge mix of smells, soapy gray water smells, wood smoke, rotting vegetables. Garbage is a major problem in the market because it's so crowded. And in the heart of the market, you can't actually drive in a vehicle. The market's grown so rapidly over the last 40 years in particular that it grew in a very disorganized fashion, although there is kind of a method to the madness in the sense of community in the market. But it's really a feast for the senses. It can be also kind of a sensory overload when you first walk into the market. I'm sure many people who've maybe traveled to open-air markets around the world have experienced something like this. What distinguishes the Oriental is that it's the largest market in Central America and one of the largest markets in Latin America. 53 super Walmarts would fit inside the size
Wow.
of the market. It's really, really massive.
And you write about how this is an example of the growing underground economy. How did you see that played out there?
Well, not all of the vendors in the market are unlicensed vendors. Roughly about a quarter of them are, but the vast majority of people in the market are working off the books. That is, they don't pay taxes on their salary. They get paid in cash. They also have no government social security. So the reason this has happened there, as in many other markets around the world, is in particular due to a series of disasters that's happened in Managua. That's what's making it grow so rapidly. People have turned to vending, to producing food out of their homes, finding a way to make a living whatever way they can as a result of a series of disasters. Managua experienced two earthquakes in the 20th century. The biggest one in 1972 killed thousands of people and leveled the city center. And when that happened, it also leveled other markets in the city. And people looking for work, looking for alternative ways to make a living, went to the one remaining market, the Oriental, where the customers were, basically, to try to make a living. And again in the 1980s, there was another disaster, in this case a war, the U.S.-backed counter-war in Nicaragua, that led people to migrate to the city. And you have, again, whenever people are migrating to the city, they're often farmers who don't have a lot of education, looking for a way to make a living, turn to, again, where the customers are, finding a way to make a living whatever way they can. Another disaster then happened in the 1990s when the government privatized public services, deregulated the business sector, and put a lot of professionals out of work. And again, they turned to the market to make a living. So it's sort of this safety net for people to survive.
And a lot of the workers there, as you said, they don't have health insurance, sick leave, any kind of benefit, really. I mean, it sounds as though they have a certain sort of flexibility, but is there any sort of regulation that, you know, should prevent these people from falling into disaster if they hit an illness or some other life hurdle?
Well, that's one of the big issues if you're a worker like Diane in the market. You are very, very vulnerable to disasters. So, for example, her son, one of her sons, Jadder, died of leukemia when he was 12. He was sick for about 5 years. And during that time, you might imagine Diane had a hard time going to work every day, which meant her business really faltered. It was harder to make a living. Without that social safety net, it's very, very hard for a lot of people to make it in response to disaster, which is one of the reasons I find this story so interesting and so compelling, this place, because we often have debates in this country about what the value of the social safety net is, what the role of government is. And the Mercado Oriental is a place where you can really see the effects of not having a very regulated economy and also that social safety net that people can fall back on.
And another aspect that you look about at in this piece is the environment and the effect here. And you draw a picture of, you know, people just tossing their garbage in the gutter. What is the environmental impact of a giant market this size?
Well, one of the things, another thing that I think is really important about the market is that it is an embodiment of the waste that is associated with the global economy. This market is not a little isolated provincial market. It's very connected to the global economy. There are products there from all over the world. And of course, our industrial system of producing things produces a lot of waste. But in the U.S., when we go, for example, to a big box store, that waste is out back, sort of tidy, right? You go into the store, it's a very clean experience. You don't see the waste that's associated with the cost of production and selling things. But in the Oriental, you do, because people are so crammed in that even though that they have a waste service, there are people who go through collecting the trash very early every morning. It's hard to keep up with it. And as I said, it's been so densely populated that garbage trucks can't get into the middle of the market. So keeping up with that is very, very hard. It does pose disease risks. And it's obviously not necessarily always a very pleasant environment to be working in. So as in most cases with pollution in the world, it's usually the poorest and the most vulnerable people who are really living with it and paying the highest costs for it.
Now, here in the United States, a lot of the focus is on making big corporations accountable for things like the environment and the impact that they may have, or things like economic transparency. But do you think it's time to start paying more attention to this underground economy that you see typified in the Mercado Oriental?
I think both are true, right? So I think it's very important, obviously, to make corporations accountable for the environmental costs of their doing business. But we're not going to have a sustainable and equitable world if we don't also pay attention to the Mercado Orientales of the world, because the vast majority of workers, I shouldn't say the vast majority, right now it's a little more than half of workers in the world are employed in the informal economy. By 2020, projections are that 2 out of every 3 people in the world will be employed in the informal economy. So we have to find ways to be able to mitigate the environmental costs of places like the Mercado Oriental as well. And also recognize the inequality that exists in the system, that inequality isn't just a result of corporate behavior, but it exists around the world, and you can really see it in places like the Mercado Oriental, where, for example, at night I've been there as the market's emptying out, and you see literally hundreds of people bedding down on cardboard to sleep or, sleep in the night there, or children stooped in the shadows sniffing glue to stave off hunger. So the regulation of the economy needs to reach both the sort of above the boards part of the economy, but also the part that's harder, at least from where we're sitting here in Wisconsin, to see.
Douglas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Douglas Haynes. He's an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. He recently wrote about the Nicaraguan market for Orion magazine. 50 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Wilderness Act, the landmark conservation bill that created and solidified America's most pristine wildlands for future generations.
The legislation is considered one of the crowning achievements in the field of conservation, but our next guest says there are still challenges to the country's wild places, and we need wilderness now more than ever.
Joining us now is Mark Peterson. He's the executive director of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute at Northland College in Ashland. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon and happy birthday.
It's right, 50 years ago, Wilderness Act 1964. So how significant a piece of legislation was this?
Well, it was very significant. In fact, in the history of the planet, there has never been another piece of legislation prior to this like the Wilderness Act, in the sense that we said as a country, we're going to mark some areas on the map that have outstanding opportunities for solitude and are largely pristine, and we're not going to touch them. We're going to leave them alone, let evolution do its work. It takes a long time, longer than our horizon, but we're going to let nature find her way, and we're going to leave those areas undisturbed. That went even beyond the concept of Yellowstone in our national parks.
How tough was it to get this passed?
Oh, it was a long, long struggle. In fact, it took really up until about 1955 for conservationists who were working to protect areas kind of one area at a time. And there would be different issues that would come up, whether it would be a dam proposal in Dinosaur National Monument that would flood large part of the park, or airplanes landing way deep in the boundary waters, disturbing people's solitude and silence. There were always issues that conservationists are beating back. And finally, by the mid-1950s, they decided really what we need to do is, rather than fight these one at a time, we really need national legislation that's going to protect in perpetuity some of these special places so we're not having to fight battles one after the other. And it took from about 1955, 56 until 1964 to pass the act. It went through something like 66 different versions of the act before it was finally passed on this date 50 years ago.
Now, Mark, you work pretty closely in this field of conservation. What does this anniversary mean to you personally?
I think personally it means really that as a nation we have decided that there are some areas that are so special and so wonderful and can teach us so much and improve the quality of our lives so greatly that we should set them aside for all time. And to do that, I think, is a remarkable achievement. There aren't too many countries in the world that even have national parks, much less a whole system of wilderness area, which today amounts to almost 110 million acres, counting Alaska, that we've decided to set aside. So I think it's kind of a crowning noble achievement of our country to recognize these wilderness values as important and valued to all of us.
Now, the boundary waters are one part of the Wilderness Act that was protective thanks to that. What are the other ones that we should know about?
Well, there's a number of them. There's 758 different areas across the country. The boundary waters is the largest one and the most visited one in our region. But they really range from very large areas in Alaska. For example, we have almost a 13 million acre wilderness area in the Gates of the Arctic in northern Alaska, to some small islands in Lake Superior, the Huron Islands, 147 acres of federal lands. These are all, I should say, federal lands, usually managed by the Forest Service or Park Service. But together, collectively, what we call this National Wilderness Preservation System of areas protects all sorts of biodiversity, all different kinds of landscapes, all different kinds of natural values that we hold up as important. Fewer in the east, and half of the wilderness system is in Alaska in terms of the acreage. So some of these large areas are up in Alaska. But even in the lower 48, the One of the largest wilderness areas is in Idaho, the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, which has the Salmon River running through it, and it's the largest unbroken wildland preserved under the Wilderness Act in the lower 48.
Now, what would you say as, you know, people who live in this country and are citizens of the world that we gain from having places like this, places that are pristine?
Well, I think there are, scientists have looked at it, and there's all sorts of different values for wilderness. A lot of it, I think a lot of people, for example, in the boundary waters relate to wilderness areas as special places to recreate in, to hike, to camp, to canoe, to fish, all these kinds of outdoor pursuits that we like to do in a wildlife setting. And through that, really, and getting into the wilderness, since you can't use motors in wilderness areas, having to enter the wilderness on our own terms with our own physical abilities. So there's certainly benefits from a physical standpoint. But beyond that, even mental benefits. We're finding wildernesses are really great areas to take perhaps youth that are challenged with a number of different things and challenge them physically in the wilderness. And they oftentimes come back out of the wilderness really with a different perspective and kind of a transformative kind of experience. We also find scientific values, things that we can learn from and derive from the plants and the processes that we've preserved in wilderness areas. So just a host of different values that are all largely non-consumptive values. These are areas that can't be exploited. We can't mine them, dam them, and that kind of thing. But all these other values that I would say, you know, enriches the human spirit are present in these wilderness areas.
Now, in 1964, when this passed, as you said, it was a bumpy road, but there was a rising tide of concern over the environment. If you were trying to pass this today, would it go over? Would you be able to pass it?
Well, that's a good question. Given our Congress today, it could be highly unlikely. Back at that time, it passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. Just very few no votes at all. So it was a time that Americans were feeling the need to preserve much of our natural resources. We felt that they were being lost, they were being exploited, and so there was this rising tide, which eventually culminated in Earth Day and the passage of environmental legislation such as the Endangered Species Act in the early 70s. But today, given the intractability of Congress, it would be very doubtful whether an act like this could be passed, as much as it receives wide support and it has worked out so well around the country.
Well, I guess another way to put the question is, do you think that conservationist sentiment and some of those values that you were talking about earlier, non-tangibles, non-consumptive values, are those still a strong current or in American culture today, or at least as strong as they were in 1964?
Well, I think I think they're stronger even than 1964. When you make the case and sit back and look at this, we have lost a lot of wilderness in the last 50 years, and that's the sad part about the Act, is that oftentimes it hasn't been able to keep up with what's been lost. But I think in terms of the speed at which our society functions, the need to go to places where we can be still and listen and learn about ourselves and our world is probably more important today, especially given all the electronic gadgetry and other things that we have to kind of distract us. But getting back to the wilderness is probably more important than it ever was.
Now, this was a piece that came out of Minnesota largely, but there were some Wisconsin luminaries there too. Who do we need to know about from the Badger State?
Well, Aldo Leopold in Baraboo certainly was one of the early proponents and visionaries of wilderness. Aldo was working down in New Mexico at the time in the Gila mountain range, and really became a convert in seeing that so much of what has been being lost, that we really need to preserve special places like this. That was really coming on the heels of John Muir, who predates Leopold, being born here in Wisconsin and spending his youth here in Wisconsin, who had really the concept of preservation, preserving lands, which we take for granted now, but at a time when northern Wisconsin was being stripped really of all the timber resources available that were growing here, the idea of planting trees or setting aside areas that would not be cut were quite novel. So between Muir and Aldo Leopold, that really helped set the stage for the Wilderness Act.
And we're going to jump in here so we can make sure to let people in on our conversation. We're talking with conservationist Mark Peterson about the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234.
What are your thoughts on the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act? Do you take time to get out in the wilderness? What are the priorities for conservation today? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act, which created the National Wilderness Preservation System and set aside nearly 110 million acres of wilderness as protected land. Now, 50 years later, what challenges are in store for the country's wild places?
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should conserving wilderness be a top priority? Is it? And what do you appreciate, if anything, about wilderness and the time you spend there? 800-642-1234 is the number. Mark Peterson is with us. He's executive director of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute at Northland College in Ashland.
And I want to ask you, despite the protections that are afforded under the Wilderness Act, there are still places that you feel need more protection. What do you see as the biggest challenges facing the country's wild places?
Well, one thing is there are many national parks like Yellowstone whose lands are not included in the Wilderness Act. And while we generally think of national parks being protected, we also know that their mandate is for recreation, and oftentimes they're not fully protected. Another more perplexing problem is how much do we manipulate wilderness when there are human-caused impacts to these areas? For example, when invasive species get in these wilderness places, when we introduce them and they spread like the pythons in the Everglades, the Burmese pythons, do we go in there and work actively to eradicate these? Do we introduce poisons into the wilderness? Things of that sort.
I want to circle back to Yellowstone. You say that they are part of the national park system, but that doesn't mean they're afforded the full extent of protections. What sorts of things are you worried about there?
Well, for example, Yellowstone, one of the issues in Yellowstone has been snowmobiles in the wintertime. Wilderness areas prohibit motorized uses, much less the emissions that snowmobiles create. So that would be an example where you might have a contradictory mandate. On one hand, national parks are to protect our natural and cultural resources, but on the other hand, they're also asked, the National Park Service is asked to allow people to enjoy and recreate in these special places. So there might be some paradox in park management, but also in the idea of wilderness management. How do you really manage wilderness, or is it just entirely hands-off?
And are there places in the country that you think should be bundled into the Wilderness Act, should be protected?
Well, I think there are many smaller places besides national parks, but that probably have been overlooked. The bias early on in the Wilderness Act was to include areas that are really majestic. We call it kind of the snow and ice and rock wildernesses, and a lot of those are the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevadas. Those really spectacular landscapes. But we've come to learn later that just as important is preserving some of our native prairie areas, some of our lake country, many of these areas that may not be quite as spectacular, but yet have outstanding opportunities for solitude and for native biodiversity to flourish.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We've got a call here from Ken in Mayville. And if you'd like to join Ken, you can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And tell us how you think conservation is keeping pace today. Ken, hi, you're on the air.
I'm originally spent the last 10 or so years in northwestern Wyoming, up in the Absaroka Range there, with a lot of wilderness. And it's absolutely amazing to be able to go out and be in solitude and everything. I had the opportunity to cook for a hunting camp for the entire month of September before I left the area. And being out there, cutting all the firewood and cooking wood that I needed for 12 wall tents to heat and everything by hand with crosscut saws, axes, hauling all of it, cooking, you know, doing everything. It just totally adds to the experience. Yeah, we were 40 miles into the wilderness, so we could only get there on horseback 40 mm-hmm. miles in. And when they would take the hunters out every week, to bring new ones in, I stayed out there all by myself and restocked and all that. And it's absolutely amazing experience. And I'm so grateful that they passed this 50 years ago.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Ken. It sounds incredible, the experience of really being in deep wilderness, having the chance to be alone and really experience that. And I wonder, Mark, do you think that's one of the biggest gifts of this, especially as we enter an increasingly wired age, the gift of total solitude?
I think Ken brings up a good point here, isn't that wilderness areas can preserve, besides the flora and fauna that we often think about in the landscape, but they also preserve endangered experiences that Americans have less and less opportunity to enjoy. For example, just a night sky that's far, far, many miles from artificial light, where you can really see the Milky Way almost like a piece of paper or a ribbon going across the night sky. These are the kinds of experiences that Ken is talking about that are less and less likely for our youth to be able to enjoy today.
And what do you think needs to be done about that? There's been some research lately that families and kids in particular are not getting out to the national parks as much as they used to. And there's been a push from Richard Louvre and others to get kids into wildlife. But is it enough? Is it working?
We find that, you know, you can't really love something unless you've experienced it. It's hard to love something in the abstract or from a textbook. But if you get students out, even for as little as 2 or 3 days, you find some really transformative experiences happening within them. We run up here with Northland College, is something we call an island school. We take students, sixth graders, out to the Apostle Island, spend 3 days in the springtime. And we find in the National Park Service, it's transformative for many of these students. They have never experienced anything like that. Things that we might even take for granted, such as camping in the woods, most of these students have never done in their lives. But they come away with a whole different perspective on, our natural world and experiences that really enrich their lives.
What kinds of things do they say after they've been through that?
Well, for example, many students coming out have never been out in really darkness before. So the idea of camping in a tent with no moon and when the sun goes down, I mean, it's blacker than black other than your campfire. I mean, this is quite a challenge for some of these inner city students. They've never had anything like that. But after 3 days, they're very comfortable in an environment like this. We're also finding, and Sigurd Olsen wrote a lot about this, people whose pressured lives, they're just running from one thing to another thing. They come to the wilderness, and it takes about 3 days for them to decompress. But after 3 or 4 days, he would write about how people would be laughing again and much happier and just much more relaxed. They don't even realize the stress that is about them and how that's impacting them until they spend a few days in the wilderness.
As someone who's celebrating on this day, what would you advise people to do if they want to honor the legacy of this act?
I think it's not only just going to a formally federally designated wilderness area, but I encourage people to get into any small pocket of wild area, or any wild resource, and it might only be a few acres in size. And I think simply, as Sigurd Olsen would write a lot about, take the time to slow down and just listen. We've kind of lost the knack of listening to what nature, the natural sounds. And we'll find from that, we take the time to think and contemplate that, I think people will come away with an enriching experience that the wilderness has given them, that is as simple as that, but can be very enriching.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, and happy birthday.
That was Mark Peterson, the executive director of the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute at Northland College in Ashland. He joined us to talk about the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. 10 years ago, Todd Cambio quit his job as a carpenter to become a luthier, specializing in guitars from the early 20th century. He sells them now to musicians around the world. Seth Jovag introduces us to the Madison Craftsman.
The best kind of analogy I have for it is the tomato. The tomato that you buy at the grocery store is engineered to have a shelf life and to look good. You know, it's red, the shape, everything looks great, but they're not bred for flavor. A lot of guitar makers make their instruments so that once they leave the shop, they never see it again. So they put really tough finishes on them. They brace them heavily so that they don't respond to changes in humidity and temperature. They don't build them necessarily for the sound. What I try to do is build them for the sound. My name is Todd Cambio. I am the owner of Fraulini Guitars in Madison, Wisconsin. I grew up in a small town called Bristol. You know, I had friends, but I wasn't in a place where my friends could come over a lot. And if they did, my older brothers would beat them up, so they never came over. So I spent a lot of time by myself, and I have always kind of played music. When I was a teenager, I really started getting into blues and playing harmonica with different blues bands. I used to go down to Chicago and play with these old guys.
All right, this is faster, I guess.
I started playing guitar in my early 20s. I lived in a place that I didn't have a television, I didn't have a stereo. All I had was a guitar. That was when I really started getting it. There was a guitar that I wanted, an old 12-string, and it was pre-eBay days, and they were impossible to find. So I thought, well, I should try to make one. And so I quit my job, and I spent the summer making a guitar. One friend said, hey, would you make me one? And so I made one for him. I made one for another friend. I was building guitars on weekends and after work down in my basement. And after a while, I thought, I wonder if I could do this for a job. I have a small shop in my backyard, and I have equipment to process raw lumber. This part of the shop is much like a guitar shop or violin shop would have been 100 years ago. There's not a lot of power tools. It's chisels and planes and saws and rasps and files. And this is where I spend most of my time. A guitar needs to be built so that it can move and that it can breathe. Kind of like a living thing, I guess. It's not a piece of furniture, you know.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik and is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org and search for Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
Now, from recreating the guitars of the past to the race to build the battery of the future. For many years now, we've relied on the lithium-ion battery for many uses. They're in our phones, our computers, some of our cars now, but they have their drawbacks as well.
Our next guest says that battery technology is one of the most important but least talked about technological frontiers, and there are some energizing technologies that could have the power to revolutionize the way we live.
Joining us now is Eric Sofgi. He's senior correspondent for Popular Mechanics. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, hi. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the technology, let's talk about the role of the battery. It seems like in this age of high-tech stuff we've got all around us, like we said, tablets to cars, the battery's kind of the unsung hero. How important is it to innovate at the battery level?
Well, yeah, if you think about sort of what we're doing with our devices now, they're essentially always connected, you know, either through Wi-Fi or, you know, cellular links. So we're always sort of pulling data, you know, or pushing data. So these things are sort of more active than they've ever been. But in the meantime, we're not really keeping up with that pace of innovation when it comes to the actual battery technology, meaning sort of our devices are sort of doing more and sort of running down quicker, and then we end up basically just charging them more, which actually kills them more quickly. You know, every time you charge a battery, you're sort of eating away at its lifespan. So it's a little bit, there's kind of an imbalance there with what we're able to do with these devices and then sort of how we're able to power them.
So why is it, as we mentioned, this lithium-ion battery, maybe we'll get into how the technology works in a bit, but why is it so challenging to improve on that or develop a whole new battery technology?
It's interesting. I think a lot of it has to do with durability, because we'll have a lot of interesting advances in the lab, and then when it comes to actually implementing those in the incredibly restrictive confines of a smartphone or the really, really brutal conditions in automotive, you know, with different temperature swings on the road and different sort of abuses that the batteries have to endure. That's where the problem comes in. It becomes almost like a manufacturing problem. So all the stuff, the sort of eureka moments in the lab, can get sort of killed by the kind of logistics of manufacturing.
So how does the current state-of-the-art battery work before we get into the innovations that people
Sure.
are trying to do?
So it can get a little bit complicated, but essentially what you have are two kinds of electrodes. So you have an anode and a cathode, and you can kind of imagine those sort of apart from each other. And then they're basically within this liquid conductive stuff, which is electrolytes. So they're kind of swimming in that sort of solution. And then you have sort of electrons will kind of move between the anode and the cathode, and those are kind of interacting and sort of releasing energy. And then between them, you have this other element that's sort of keeping those electrodes from coming into contact with each other. So again, it might sound a little confusing, but essentially you have two active sort of components which are gradually releasing energy, and you have to have them interact with each other, but you also have to keep them from coming into contact, or else the whole system actually will sort of overheat and it can explode.
And not so, catching fire is a key to what consumers want in a good battery, I imagine.
It is. Even though it's actually a very sort of very, very rare and sort of overhyped kind of issue, it is a problem. You know, it's a problem when you try to increase the actual capacity of this technology, either for sort of quicker recharge rates or for sort of more energy density. When you start to really push that, you can actually make the overheating and the explosion issue an actual issue rather than what it is now, which is kind of more on the end of fear-mongering.
And in your piece, you track one of the contenders trying to make this battery of the future, correct my pronunciation if need be, the Prieto battery.
Yeah.
So who are the innovators there? What are they trying to do different?
So this is a very cool company based out of Colorado State University, and they are essentially making a 3D battery, or they have made it. They haven't really brought it to market yet, but it appears that they're getting really close. So I described before the anode and the cathode and that sort of liquid electrolyte that they're in that helps them sort of conduct energy between, and also that other element that keeps the anode and the cathode from touching and making the whole thing blow up. So this basically takes a lot of that stuff out of the equation. There's no liquid electrolyte, which is great because that's the stuff that actually does ignite. And there's no real need to actually keep those other elements of Parth anode and the cathode with this sort of flimsy panel or sort of plastic film, which can get ruined. The whole system is in a way kind of inert in the way that you want it to be. Even though it's really conducting electricity and sort of has this incredible capacity, it's not active in the way that other lithium-ion batteries can be, which again can sort of lead to overheating and sort of manufacturing issues and trying to prevent them from overheating.
Well, I love the moment you describe the two principles here in this design, or just at the local diner, it sounds like, saying, hey, watch this video while your kid eats ice cream there. Hey, look, this thing actually works. That's the eureka bit, I guess, but how now when you've got this innovation, how do you get it out there? How do you get a tablet manufacturer, an auto manufacturer to take this thing seriously and put it in your product?
It's an interesting challenge that they have because this is it's a very small company, 9 people at the moment, and so they don't really have the ability to produce this stuff in any meaningful way. But they've actually come up with a production process for making these, which is actually relatively cheap, and really is interesting because it doesn't use any toxic chemicals, which also brings down the cost and makes it so that you can sort of begin producing this stuff. You can create manufacturing lines that don't require like a giant clean room sort of or huge investment. So what they're trying to do is basically push the battery technology, it's really pretty amazing. It can hold about 5 times more energy than a standard battery, and it can charge exponentially quicker. So maybe like minutes instead of hours.
Wow.
To charge a phone to full. So what they've done, though, that I think is unique is that they've created this new production process. They've actually done a pilot, you know, at their lab and said, okay, so here's the battery technology and here's how you make it. And so it's kind of a double-pronged sort of push on their end to get a larger company to sort of pick up, again, the actual technology and the sort of way of producing it. But I feel like they can get there because one of the main issues that other companies have had is saying, here's a great technology, but we don't really know how to make it, or we do, and it's really expensive and requires huge investment. This thing isn't really like that. You can begin producing this in really small batches and then sort of gradually ramp up.
Eric, thanks so much for being with us today to describe the hunt for the battery of the future.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
That's Eric Sofci. He's senior correspondent for Popular Mechanics. He recently wrote a piece looking at the future of battery technology.